तस्मिन् महाव्योम्नि प्रलीन शशिभास्करे संक्षुप्ता पदवन्मूढा प्रबुध स्यादनावृतः तदाक्रम्य बलं मन्त्रा सर्वज्ञ बलशालिना प्रवर्तन्ते धिकाराय करणानीव देहिना तत्रैवासं प्रलीयन्ते शान्तरूपा निरञ्जना सहारध कचित्तेन तेनैते शिवधर्मिनः यस्मात् सर्वमयो जीवात् सर्वभावात् समुद्भवात् तत्संवेदनरूपेण तादात्म्य प्रतिपत्तितः तस्माच्छब्दार्थचिन्तासु न सावस्तानया शिव भोक्तैव भोग्यभावेन सदा सर्वत्र संस्थितः इति वायस्य संवित्ति कृतात्वेन अखिलं जगात् सपश्यन् सततं युक्तो जीवन्मुक्तो न संशयः अयमेवोदयस्थस्य ध्येयस्य ध्यायी चेतसि तदात्मता समापतिरिचत साधकस्य या इयमेवामृतप्राप्तिरयमेवात्मनोग्रह इयं निर्वाणदीक्षा च शिवसर्पावदायिनि यथेच्छाभ्यर्थितो दाता जाग्रतोर्तान् हृदि स्थितान् सोमसूर्योदयं कृत्वा सम्पादयति देहिनः तथा स्वप्नेभ्यभीष्टार्तान् प्रणयस्यानति क्रमा नित्यं स्फुटतरं मध्ये स्थितो वशं प्रकाशये अन्यथा तु स्वतन्त्रा स्यात् सृष्टिस्तधर्मकत्वतः सततं लौकिकस्येव जाग्रत्स्वप्नपदाद्वये यथा ह्यको स्फुटो दृष्टः सावधानेऽपि चेतसि भूयस्फुटतरो भाति स्वबलोद्योगभावितः तथा यत्परमार्थेन येन यत्र यथा स्थितम् तत्तथा बलमाक्रम्य न चिरात् सम्प्रवर्तते दुर्बलोऽपि तदाक्रम्य यत कार्ये प्रवर्तते आच्छदयेत् बुभुक्षं च तथा योति बुभुक्षितः अनेनादिष्टिते देहे यथा सर्वज्ञदादया तथा स्वत्मन्यदिष्टानात् सर्वत्रैवं भविष्यति ग्लानिर्विलुण्ठिका देहे तस्यश्च ज्ञानतस्वति तदुन्मेष विलुप्तं चेत् कुतसा स्यादहेतुका एकचिन्ता प्रसक्तस्य यत स्यादपरोदय उन्मेष साधु विज्ञेया स्वयं तमुपलक्षये अतो विन्दुरतो नादो रूपमस्मारतो रस प्रवर्तन्ते चिरणेव क्षोभकत्वेन देहिनः दृक्षये
Hello. I'd like to welcome you, all of you, to this beautiful and brilliant third class of our Spandakarika's practice. We're entering deeper and deeper into this approach to life that is called tantric, this approach that really makes only the slenderest of distinctions between that which we call divine and that which we call ordinary. And one of the reasons that we're able to enter so deeply into this is because of the years of experience that so many of you bring to the practice and bring to the class. So I'd like to start by thanking you for the beauty and the power of not only your meditation and your contemplation, but also of the way in which you've been sharing your experience and your questions and your wisdom, both on the listserv and also silently. So, because I know that many of you who are silent on the listserv are actually adding wisdom through what I like to call the Shakti vortex here. So some of you are used to practicing with subtle energy of the body through yoga. Others have more of a vipassana mindfulness style practice. Some of you do a lot of self-inquiry. Some of you practice the mantra. And many of you are very used to entering into the subtler parts of the body-mind through the heart. But every single person here adds your piece to the field that's being generated, to the Shakti vortex, the field of open awareness that exists among all of us and that actually empowers everybody who comes into this field, whether live on the call or through the MP3, wherever and whenever you're listening in. Every one of you gets to experience the support of this field in deepening our own practice. So really, we're co-creating this field because a true Shakti field literally does need to be co-created. It can never be the creation of a single individual or even a lineage. And this is one of the recognitions that in modern times, and especially in the last 20 or 30 years, we're starting to recognize in a very deep way that all practice, all awakening is in a certain sense mutual awakening or awakening that takes place among us. Whether we subscribe to Rupert Sheldrake's understanding about the morphic resonance, the shared field, or whether it's just our experience that there are certain company, let's say, that makes it easier to enter into our own deepest experience. It's always, to some degree or another, a shared creation. And of course, it also comes from the centuries and centuries and centuries of practice that beings who've looked into this tradition and looked into the deep experience of non-duality have all contributed to the field. And this vortex that we're within has allowed and will continue to allow that enormous subtlety of inner and outer experience and of inner experience seeping into the outer, which is central to tantric teachings and which we find in our moments of peace and also in our moments of extreme busyness, that there's this same invitation to recognize the divine source, the Spanda. It's easier, of course, for most of us when the mind is still and focused inside, but it also arises, the invitation into it arises at any moment. It's present in questions, it's present in expansion experiences, it's present in contraction experiences, it's present in emotions, and I do believe that one of the gifts we get from working with a text like this in the different ways we're working with it is that we are actually able to recognize, to realize, and to be with this truth that the text is explaining. So I'd like to read, before we begin our invocations, a statement from Daniel Odier, who's Of course, one of the contemporary commentators on the Spandakarikas, whom we've been looking at, it's one of the recommended texts. Odia comes from a tradition that's not directly in the lineage of Kashmir Shaivism. At least, actually, that's not true. But the book is, he does come from a lineage of Kashmir Shaivism, but not exactly the one that the text speaks about. And he has very great insight into certain aspects of the process, as well as, of course, the capacity to translate it into our 21st century language. So this is what he says about the verses that we're going to be practicing with today. And if you have your handouts, they're verses 6, 7, and 8 of the Spandakarika. So here's Odie. The great subtlety of the tantric masters was to take the whole of human passions and to ask themselves of these questions, quote, how to make it so that all is used, nothing is denied, nothing is rejected. How to make it so that we will not find ourselves one day face to face with our own demons, who always come back to us in hordes to destroy the quest. The answer is truly a great finding. We penetrate the real, that is, the apparent world, the world we experience with our senses. We touch it with our whole being, and there we discover the absolute. So I'm going to say it again. We penetrate the real, that is, the apparent world. You know, in our time, we call the world of the senses the real world, even though it's actually no more real than the inner world, and according to the sages of Tantra, and certainly the sages of Vedanta, not necessarily as completely real. So we penetrate the world we experience as our senses, with our senses. We touch it with our whole being, and there we discover the absolute. Before this inspired turnaround, the absolute was considered to be something far off that we needed to release from any all too human aspects in order to reach a state that was not tainted by suffering. So here's really the gift of deciding that we're going to surf reality with the grace of the tantric sages. We discover that even those things that ordinarily cause suffering, including emotions, feelings, our ordinary desires for food, for the various undertakings that we call ambition, for sexuality, if we all the different cravings and feelings of lack that craving often comes from, if we approach these with the right kind of understanding and learn to use them as doorways into the divine source, which sometimes means simply relaxing into allowing what is arising to arise, then we discover the spanda, the source of it, within everything. And within that spanda, we discover the even subtler source within which the spanda, the power of creativity leading to manifestation, that even subtler source, that peaceful source, trembling with bliss, within which spanda arises. So we're going to chant our invocation to Shakti, to the goddess. Mahite wrote into the listserv that she's missing the form of the goddess in these classes that are not so much about the actual specific deity forms. And Christine wrote back that actually in the mantras we find these forms. So as we have more or less identified these mantras with the qualities of inspiration, of the capacity to create with divine pleasure, with that power which removes obstacles, which cuts obstacles, let's also remember that they refer to specific goddess forms. Ayin invokes the goddess Saraswati, the goddess of speech, inspiration. Rim invokes the goddesses Bhuvaneshwari, she who holds all spaciousness within her, as well as Lalita Tripura Sundari, who is the most beautiful of all the forms of the divine feminine and is also filled with what are called the erotic sentiments of pure creative enjoyment of all manifestation. Kleem, which stands for the divine pleasure often associated with Lalita or with Goddess Lakshmi, the goddess of abundance. Chamunda, which is one of the names of Kali, the goddess of who dissolves all, everything that separates us into herself. Viche, meaning, which refers to the goddess Kali or Chamunda's capacity for removing obstacles. And Swaha, the wonderful sound of really letting go into reality. So we'll chant 9 times. And you can chant along with me, although my voice is a little hoarse, I have to confess. So we'll really take this moment to let the breath flow in the way that it naturally flows, with a feeling that the breath is arising from within the very heart of the universe, the Spanda Shakti herself, that our bodies open to receive the breath, to feel ourselves allowing whatever has been distracting us during the day to flow out with the exhalation. And to feel that with the inhalation we take in the divine intention of Shakti, the divine intention of the liberating force of Spanda to awaken us more and more deeply to the love that is at the heart of everything. And in that recognition, we'll invoke the goddesses of enlightened awareness who also appear as everything within our experience. Om Aim Rim Klim Chamundaye Viche Swaha. 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 And we'll chant the auspicious first verse of the Spanda Karikas, the verse that invokes both the source of all energies and the energies themselves, praising Shankara, who is the source of the power of the wheel of energies, by whose expansion, Unmesha, and contraction, Nimesha, the universe is absorbed and comes into being. And we'll chant this verse 3 times.
Yasyon mesha nimesha pyam jagata pralayo dayau tam shakti chakra vibhava prabhavam shankaram stumaha. Yasyon mesha nimesha pyam jagata pralayo dayau Tam Shakti Chakra Vibhava Prabhavam Shankaram Stumaha. Yasyon Mesha Nimesha Bhyam Jagata Pralayodayau. Tam Shakti Chakra Vibhava Prabhavam Shankaram Stumaha. So with your awareness, again, with the breath, we're going to begin with one of the really classic, let's call it, strategies for recognizing the divine Shakti within our own experience. This is the practice of meditating on the source of the breath. And in this meditation, we're going to focus on the place outside the body where the breath, where the exhalation dissolves and from which it arises. So you can find a posture that feels a little bit more upright as well as comfortable. Feel your buttocks against the seat and become present to the slight pressure that you experience between, in the connection between your buttocks, your hips, your thighs, and the seat. Be aware of how, as the breath flows in, there's a sinking into connection with the earth, with the seat you're sitting on. And as the exhalation rises, you can allow the exhalation to allow your body to very, very gently elongate itself upward through the crown. Feel the chest lift and open. The shoulder blades release onto the back. Feel the edges of what we consider our physical body being touched by the air around us. Feel how, if you really experience yourself without thoughts or without ideas about what is inside and what is outside, that the experience of the physical body, especially if your eyes are closed, which I will suggest for you now, your experience of the physical body is simply the experience of sensation. Some of the sensations being very subtle, some of them being more intense. And the experience of what you might call your skin meeting what you might call the air actually has a tingly, vibrating, quite pleasurable quality to it that we're often unaware of. So begin to recognize the ebb and flow of the breath, the unmesha nimesha, the inhalation flows in, the exhalation flows out, and little by little begin to become aware in a more direct and more closely focused way of how at the end of the exhalation, the feeling of the moving breath actually dissolves into space, dissolves into the apparent emptiness in front of you. See if you can softly focus on that place where the exhalation dissolves into the air, recognizing that this space at the end of the exhalation is what my guru used to call the God space, the space of the self, the place where spanda,
is very deeply present. And see if you can let the breath remain there until the impulse to breathe in arises. So your focus is on that space at the end of the exhalation. And at a certain point, without straining, without holding the breath, you'll notice that the impulse to inhale simply arises and the breath is drawn back into the body. But you're going to see if you can keep your attention now on that space at the end of the exhalation from which the impulse to inhale arises. You're letting the breath happen on its own. But with a soft focus, you're noticing how the moving flow of breath dissolves into that space from which it arises as an inhalation. Have the feeling of beginner's mind, the intention to notice how in this apparently empty space outside the body, there is this force which comes out of stillness, out of apparent nothingness, out of the empty fullness that is the source of breath and brings the inhalation in. Feel Spanda Shakti breathing you from that place where the breath merges outside and from which it arises. Today we're going to look at verses 6, 7, and 8, which are a group of verses that all begin one of the really fundamental teachings of the tantric tradition, which is about the process of desire, about desire or will or impulse. These are names, actually names for spanda, really about the natural quality of desire that we ourselves experience as the impulse behind pretty much everything in life, which the tantras tell us is our individuated experience of the fundamental creative impulse of the divine. So we're going to talk about desire from several different points of view, and we're also going to meditate on the source of desire from several different points of view. So verse 6, I'll say the Sanskrit first and then the English, and actually verse 6 and 7 are usually looked at together. Yata karana vargo yam vimudo mudavat swayam sahantarena chakrena pravriti stiti samhritihi labhate tat prayatnena parikshyam tatvamadarat yata swatantrita tasya sarvatrayam akritrima. The last word in this verse is akritrima, which means natural. In other words, not contrived, not created by anything outside of reality. So here's the translation of the verses. That principle should be examined with great care and reverence. I love this idea, with reverence, by which the group of senses, though insentient, act as a sentient force by itself, and along with the inner group of senses, goes towards objects, takes pleasure in their maintenance, and withdraws into itself. Because the natural freedom of that principle, that is spanda, prevails everywhere. So these two words, swatantrata, which means absolute freedom, self-will, self-freedom, akritrima, natural, the natural swatantra, the natural freedom of spanda, prevails even when it seems as though the senses are being completely entangled, and when the mind and and ego feel totally stuffed and filled with even suffering experience. So before we continue and talk about the actual words of the verse themselves, and I also want you to know that I'm going to send you a little commentary on them as part of your homework, because there are some technicalities in this, these two verses that are interesting for some of us to look at. But first, let's just read verse 8. Nahichano danasyayam prerakthavena vartate api twatma bala sparsat purushas tatsamo bhavet. And this is really the key. Indeed, the individual soul does not activate the impulse of the will, which directs the body's activities, by itself alone, but through contact with his own inner power, made in such a way that he identifies with it. And this is another verse. The empirical individual cannot drive the goad of desire, but by coming in contact with the power of the self, he becomes equal to that principle, which is a verse that really describes the experience of an enlightened being who literally identifies so fully with the divine will that there's no sense of separation between his personal experience and the experience of the divine, the experience of God. So I want to just start by discussing desire. First of all, desire is an enormously loaded word in spirituality. We often think of, when we use the word desire, we often think of sexual desire, the desire for pleasure, the desire for so-called ambitious outcomes, and in spiritual practice, the desire for an experience or for a good experience to stay or an unpleasant experience to go away, desire for a particular outcome, which in many traditions is called seeking mind. You know, seeking has kind of a bad reputation in some circles because, you know, it's said that when we are seeking or when we are desiring, we're actually not accepting reality as it is. And of course, if we've come out of an ascetic religious tradition, including many of the mystical traditions like Buddhism and Hinduism and contemplative Christianity, and also some aspects of Judaism, we associate desire with something that's intrinsically opposed to spirituality. Unless it's desire for God or desire for truth, in which case desire is usually given another name. It's usually given the name longing. Or in the Vedantic tradition, it's associated with this quality that in Sanskrit is called mumukshutva, which literally means the intense longing for freedom. So the idea that the desire for pleasure that is, you know, in and of itself is the cause of suffering, or that it's something we need to get rid of in order to be in deep meditation, is a core idea in Buddhist and Hindu training. I remember that some years ago I was giving a talk in a course that was called The Four Goals of Life. And in Hindu thought, the four goals of life are said to be dharma, which in this tradition means righteous action, right action. Artha, which usually is translated as success in the material world, whether financial or political. Kama, which is the Sanskrit word for pleasure, especially sexual pleasure, and moksha, which means liberation. And as I started to prepare my talk, I thought it would be a really good idea to have a group of people, get a group of people together and have a kind of a focus group on desire. Now, everyone in the group, I think there were about 10 people there, had been practicing for a while. Every single one of them had a negative view of desire. So when I asked them about their experience of desire, they talked about how successful they'd been in eliminating desires, or how, you know, how much they'd failed to eliminate desires. So they each had this very deep assumption that desire is bad unless, you know, it's your desire for the truth. Now, what the Skataka tells us is that desire is not only natural and inevitable in embodied life, but it's also a basic activity of the divine, and that the goad, the spur, the impulse of desire is not under our control. That's an incredibly important thing to realize, even though, as we'll see later, it's not an excuse for, you know, following every stray impulse. And we will talk about that later on. Yet from one point of view, there is no impulse or desire that we can have, especially not the impulses and desires that power our experience of our individual embodied life. There's no desire that we are making happen. So I just have found this recognition, this understanding to be such a powerfully transformative experience. And it's one of the reasons why we often say that the desire for truth or the desire for spiritual experience is not something that we can make happen any more than, you know, for instance, I think most of us have had the experience at some point of, you know, of wanting to be sexually attracted to somebody or wanting somebody to be sexually attracted to us, and finding that try as we would, we couldn't summon that desire, or, you know, we couldn't get the other person to summon that desire. And the reason for that is sexual desire is it's one of those forms of desire that somehow we become extremely aware of when it's present or when it's absent. But you know how we often say in popular literature, you can't choose to fall in love. We also can't choose to feel desire. It comes or it doesn't come. And this is, I think, one of the ways in which the sages became most aware of the fact that the impulse of desire is not under our control, even though, of course, there are certain things that might tend to coax it forward, just as there are certain activities that coax the experience of the divine to become more present. But the point is that desire is actually, now we're not talking just about sexual desire, but about the real desire as the very, very basic motivation for thought and action. And it's always revealing itself and fulfilling itself in every nanosecond. In the Vedas, which is the very ancient and supposedly divinely revealed text of India, there's a verse that says, kama, desire, is the first seed of creation. And that word kama is sometimes translated as love, but what it actually means is passion, is desire. And, you know, on one level, of course, this does refer to the sexual act, as in Michael Pollan's wonderful book, The Biology of Desire, you know, in which he makes the point that the birds and the bees are also motivated by this power of desire. The whole process of pollination and growth is an activity of desire. The bee wants the perfume of the flower, the flower wants to attract the bee. But behind all this is the fact that one of the great doorways into divine experience is to get in touch with the pure impulse of divine desire. In Sanskrit, the word is icha, which means will or longing or desiring. And as we said last week, in the Shiva Sutras, the text of Kashmir Shaivism that is sometimes considered to be the core text of this tradition, there's a sutra which says that the power of will, the icha shakti, that is the impulsion that we experience towards action, is a direct expression of the original impulse that gives rise to manifestation. So just for a moment, see if you can touch into that quality in your own awareness, in your own body-mind, that is the stir of desiring. Whether it's the desire to hear better or the desire to understand or something else that's coming up and distracting you or taking you deeper, see if you can notice how the pulsation that we've been talking about as an intrinsic aspect of the presence of spanda in our individual experience, how that pulsation often takes the form of a very subtle feeling of desiring or grasping. And what the text says or what the commentators say is that this desiring quality is our individual expression of the stir of pure icha. And, you know, I'm just going to give you a very short metaphysical explanation of how this works. You know, if you'll remember, we're talking here about the ultimate reality as a vast, endless expansiveness of awareness bliss or consciousness bliss. It's called Chidananda. Chid meaning consciousness, ananda meaning bliss. This vast ocean of bliss and awareness, undulating in ecstatic self-satisfaction. And that undulation, which is an intrinsic part of the consciousness bliss, stirs up like that tiny little current in the ocean that is the precursor to a wave forming. And that is the original stirring of the Ichha Shakti, that is, the Spanda, consciousness bliss, naturally stirs as the experience of will, of impulse. And this impulse then evolves into a specific intention, a thought form. In other words, content arises. And on a cosmic level, that thought form is the knowing that it's being moved to create, to manifest. Another word for this is sankalpa, which means intention. And that sankalpa is will with content. In other words, it's not just a pure impulse, it's also an impulse towards. And another word for that is the jnana shakti, the knowledge formed intention for creating something, doing something, making something, being something. The word jnana, which is usually translated as knowledge, in this context means particularity, particular form. And on the cosmic level, we might say that the thought form, the sankalpa, is something like, let something manifest, let there be a universe in you and me. It could be, you know, I want a drink of water, or I want to take a class in Spanda, or I want this guy to be my boyfriend, or I want an ice cream, or in this moment in me, there's this impulse that's taking form as a tickle in my throat, and the knowledge that arises is I need to cough, and then the action comes forth as, you know, that pulsation of sound, that contraction of the throat that we call a cough. So the impulse becomes an idea, and the idea evolves into an act, an action. The body moves towards fulfilling its object of desire. And this sequence, impulse, idea, activity, whatever occurs in our lives, whether it's moving our arm to getting out of bed in the morning, to making a phone call, to studying for a PhD, is a combination of these three qualities of will, knowing, and action, of impulse, idea, and activity. And the Spanda on the cosmic level is, you know, the action that evolves is what we call the Big Bang, the explosion into physical manifestation. But many of you will recognize, as, you know, having heard the word sankalpa, is that in contemporary practice, in yoga practice, as well as so-called New Age practice and, you know, coaching practice, we make use of this intuitive understanding that desire needs to be actually given form as a particular intention or sankalpa. In other words, there needs to be a kind of conscious knowing or decision about how the desire is to be expressed before we act. In other words, we have methods for harnessing that innate movement from impulse to idea to action by deliberately turning in and discovering what lots of people in the contemporary self-help world called our passion. You know, what is your passion in this moment? Which is, of course, another word for the pure impulse of desire, and then creating a well-formed and specific thought form, a sankalpa. I'm, you know, one of my friend's daughter decided she was going to Yale, and in her junior year in high school, she created this affirmation, I am going to Yale, and she put it on her mirror, and she practiced this sankalpa, along with, of course, doing all the things that you need to do in order to make yourself a qualified candidate for an Ivy League school. And she did actually end up going to Yale. Not all of our sankalpas work out so seamlessly. But this understanding of the power of sankalpa harnessed to desire, harnessed to action, actually invokes these three natural aspects of consciousness, which is why this this particular technique is so effective for so many people. So so the truth is, however, that whether or not we're deliberately creating sankalpas, this sequence of will or desire, intention or thought, and then activity is actually going on endlessly in every moment of our lives. And this is actually what verses 6 and 7 are saying. They're saying that our senses, that is the eyes, the ears, the sense of taste and the tongue, the sense of smell in the nostrils, the feeling of touch, which, you know, are actually enormously complex activities that have their, that are composed of many, many different neuronal combinations. You know, they take place in the brain, they take place in the nervous system, and they also take place in what we think of as our mind, you know, that part of us that thinks and decides, and also through the sense of ego, of being a particular person identified with a personal history and a body. What the text says, and if you look at verses 6 and 7, you see that that the translation actually says the group of senses, though insentient, though unconscious, act as sentient forces by themselves. In other words, you and I feel that, you know, there's a certain power that is making the eyes see, that is making the ears hear, that is giving us the experience of taste. What we've also come to realize is that these powers of sight, of hearing, of taste, etc., can actually be experienced independently of the actual organs that we think are doing it. There's an article in the current New Yorker by a writer named Adam Gopnik, which talks about how they've discovered a computer model in which they can recreate the sense of touch in a prosthetic hand by calibrating vibrational waves in a particular way. And interestingly enough, the effective vibrations are vibrations that move at the same basic rate as the human heartbeat. But what they've discovered, in other words, is that the experience of touch and all its different combinations, you know, having to do with pressure, with the connection of skin on skin, there are a number of different parts of the sensation of touch, that they can be produced inside the human psyche through combinations of essentially sound waves, which leads to the conclusion that the sense of touch, like the sense of sight, is not actually necessarily connected with the physical organs, because there's something in the body, in the nervous system, which is activated by corresponding waves or vibratory combinations that can be produced kind of mysteriously, even in the absence of the physical sense. So one of the famous stories about this is a story of a man named Jacques Lucerne, who was in the resistance in France during World War II, who was blind from the age, I can't remember if it was from birth or from a very young age, but he discovered that even without sight, he had an experience of an inner light, and that light actually guided him through the physical world, also guided him morally and intellectually, because one of the things he discovered was that when he was angry or upset or out of touch with himself, he couldn't see the light. That, in other words, some degree of inner stillness was necessary. So the Spandakarika says that even beyond the brain and nervous system, the senses, and by senses they include the mind, the ego, and the intellect, which are considered inner senses or inner instruments, and also the organs of speech, of grasping, etc. In other words, the instruments through which the human self interacts with what we perceive as the outside world. All of these have no power to act except through the spanda. And the verse suggests in a kind of complicated way that we can use the power of the senses, the mind, and the ego to turn inward and begin to examine its source. So let's just do that for a moment. Be present with the breath. And this time, allow yourself to feel the hopefully pleasurable touch of breath as it flows in and out of the body. If you let the breath flow naturally and focus on the sense of the touch of the breath, there is actually a very pleasurable experience. But as we've already said and seen, we are not actually bringing the breath in and out. We are not actually breathing. And I know that if we have obstructions in the breath, or even if we don't, many of us tend to believe that we have to breathe. And when we do yogic pranayama, this sometimes increases our sense that I am breathing. But if you can let yourself just be present to the flow of breath, and notice the place at the end of the exhalation where the breath comes to an end, see if you can just examine with care and reverence, with a recognition that what you are looking at or feeling into is more accurate, is the mysterious source of the breath. So this is a very, let's say, physical way of tuning into that principle. The Spanda principle, which in our most immediate experience is found as the source of breath, as the one who draws the breath into the body and pushes the breath out, using the lungs, using the nostrils. Sometimes using our attention, as in many yogic practices. But being itself the mover of the breath. So I'd like to suggest that as we continue see if you can keep some part of your attention on that place at the end of the exhalation, which is empty. energy, which is actually has no bellows in it. It has no physically observable source, but it is this subtle impulsion that when the breath has dissolved into space in front of the body, it actually becomes the source that is drawing the breath back in. Honestly, it's not your lungs that's making that happen. It's not the movement of your lungs. Even though if you consciously expand your lungs, the breath will be able to penetrate more deeply into your body. Nonetheless, the breath is happening on its own through the impulsion of the Spanda Shakti. So just be present to that space. Letting yourself be breathed, you might notice that there are moments of resistance or awkwardness or distraction, which are also part of the experience, so we just let them be there. They're manifestations of the limited I-self, of the egoic self, but they're also manifestations of the divine Spanda, because it is the Spanda which is manifesting as the sense of I, and that is manifesting as the impulse behind the thoughts that come up. And see if you can notice as you let yourself be breathed that within that experience you can feel pulses of desire, the impulse to think, the impulse that brings up thoughts, the impulse to hear and understand what I'm saying. And as you notice these arisings of desire or impulse behind thought or behind feeling, just notice them and recognize that just as the heartbeat is taking place, just as breathing is happening, the life of the body is being lived, is being supported by this divine invisible force that runs through your visible embodied experience. So the actual felt experience of surrender, that incredibly significant spiritual term, which anyone who's had some, put in some time in the trenches of the spiritual world will recognize as perhaps one of the goals, one of the great goals of one of the things that we want to understand or experience more deeply in spiritual life. Basically, the experience of surrendering begins to be natural as you start to allow yourself to feel the degree to which you're being lived by this force that acts through the senses and the mind. So, again, verse 8, the empirical individual, that is you and me, cannot drive the goad of desire. But by coming into contact with the power of the self, that is, with that presence that is there at the very heart of the breath, in the space between one breath and another, in the opening into emptiness that we have perhaps been experiencing in some of the meditations in this class, by coming into contact with the power of the self, which is moving our body-mind, a practitioner becomes equal to that force, the spanda, which is the source of desire. So the word goad, you know, as many of you know, the goad appears in lots of the pictures of the goddess, is that little hooked metal thing that an elephant trainer uses to drive an elephant. So it's a kind of a cruel instrument, you know, that the elephant driver will hook it into the skin of the elephant and make the elephant do his will. It's a, you know, really graphic image of what desire does for us. So it's this goad, it's the sharp intensity of desire that actually drives us forward. And if you remember in the Bhagavad Gita, when there's this moment when Krishna asks Arjuna, how he can, you know, when Krishna tells Arjuna that he doesn't want to fight, Arjuna says to him, you know, that's not under your control. You can't choose to fight, not to fight, because the force of nature, meaning the spanda, is going to force you to move whether you like it or not. So one of the really most significant points that these verses make is that at the deepest level, there is no such thing as individual will. And I know that I'm giving a, you know, kind of an easy answer to one of the great questions that we talk about endlessly in spiritual life. Is there or is there not choice? What the text says is that on the ultimate level, there is no choice. In other words, the chooser, the goad behind desire is Shakti herself, is Spanda herself. The force that drives the green shoot, in Dylan Thomas's words, also drives you. In other words, your life is one with the great life. And I find this a very comforting idea. For some reason, it's particularly comforting in intense, difficult times. And we are going to go into it at a deeper level, and we're going to be contemplating it this week individually. And I just want to say that this understanding doesn't mean that we don't make choices. I'll get back to that later. But when we get down to it, even though your personal will, you know, is in one sense a unique expression of the divine. In other words, the decisions that this being called Christine or this being called Daria makes are particular to her. Decisions Aaron makes are particular to him. But nonetheless, all of these expressions are being carried by this underlying impulse towards the Shakti's expression as all these individuals, in other words, divine will. So we're sparks of the divine will. Our will is not other than the divine will. Our mind is not other than the divine mind. Our very resistance to turning inside, our very feeling of being cut off from ourselves, is the result of divine will. And that is constantly acting through us and with us. That's what allows our senses to work and our minds to think. You know, Spanda functions as the basic program that runs through the DNA, through all the biological and neural pathways. And this is why the traditional ascetic approach to spiritual practice, where the practitioner is told to stop his senses and mind from turning outward, it's why this approach is so hard, so challenging, why, in fact, it doesn't really work. And, you know, if you remember that Zen story, it's a very famous story, I think most of you probably know it, about the man who's being chased by a tiger, and he's running for his life, and he comes to a cliff, and he's about to jump over it. Apparently it's a small cliff, when he sees at the bottom of the cliff another tiger with open jaws, and he's holding onto a branch with the one tiger snapping ahead of him, on top of him, and the other tiger snapping below him. And the story goes on to say there's a mouse which is gnawing on the branch. So the truth is he's about to drop. And then he sees a strawberry just within his reach. And with his free hand, he grasps the strawberry and puts it in his mouth and tastes it. And the last line of the Zen story is, it's so delicious. So in a certain sense, the driving force of desire is that impulse which makes us taste the strawberry, which makes us taste life and find it delicious. You know, there's this intrinsic deliciousness in life. And Tantra is really all about that deliciousness. So what happens, for example, those of us who've had the experience of going into deep meditation, the experience is not that we make ourselves go into that deep meditative state. It's that that deep meditation state arises and takes us. In other words, the force that I sometimes call the meditation current inside our being brings these states forward. And this is not only true of meditation, it's also true of ordinary life. A friend of mine once told me a story that he's a very compulsive and, you know, self-directed person, and he used to think that if he didn't goad himself mercilessly to keep functioning, you know, to keep achieving, to keep striving, that he'd just collapse. He'd never get out of bed. He'd just turn into a, you know, complete lazy heroin addict or something. And one day he decided that he would test this, that he'd just stay in bed. He would not get up until getting up happened on its own. And he lay in bed for about 3 hours after waking up in the morning. And he found that at a certain point, something moved in him, which was deeper than his decision, and was a combination. There's a little bit of hunger in it, but more than that, it was this deep impulsion to move. Got him out of bed. And he saw that an essentially healthy body can't help moving and getting out of bed when it's waking up rested. When the body's hungry, it eats. So the spanda is expressed in our biological urges, our natural behaviors. And, you know, when we talk about the action of non-action, it always reminds me of one of my early experiences of awake consciousness. I'd come out of a very powerful meditation experience in which I had really gone very deep, or I wouldn't say gone, something had risen from within and taken me over. And when my so-called ordinary waking state appeared again, it was without normal self-consciousness, without the feeling of having to figure out what to say. In other words, there was a spontaneous activity going on. I would greet people, I would speak to people with no sense that I was doing it, and in a very, very free and very loving and very pleasurable way. So when for a while the judging mind, you know, the self-conscious feeling of having to be the doer had dissolved through that meditative experience, something else was moving through the body and speech all on its own, much better than I normally did. So when Krishna tells Arjuna that he might as well do his dharma as a warrior and fight, that is to join his will with his destiny in life in a spirit of service, he's really making this crucial point about the connection between divine will and personal choice. So, in other words, even though we don't have the power to make our senses work, we obviously do have the power in many, many ways to exercise intention, and that these intentions give coherence and congruity to our actions. If we didn't exercise intentions, our life would be a series of random and aimless movements. And this is the paradox of human expression. It's an incredible paradox. It's an incredible mystery. On the one hand, there's no such thing as free will. And on the other hand, we have choice. But the question is, which is which? So I'm going to tell you an anecdote that has always moved me a lot. A few years ago, I was on a flight from Monterey to Phoenix, which is a one-class flight. So I found myself sitting next to a guy who probably would have been in first class normally. And he turned out to be a retired U.S. Army general who had been in command of one of the most important battles in the recent history of this country. And it was the NATO battle at Kosovo. And on his last leave before the decisive battle, he and his wife went to church. His wife was a Catholic. He was not a particularly observant person, but he loved his wife. He went along, and he noticed that there was a stained glass window near the altar that showed St. George and the dragon. And if you remember, St. George has a spear that he's piercing the dragon with. And as he looked, the dragon's spear came alive and seemed to come out of the stained glass window and pierce his third eye. Pierce his forehead, and he said it was like a download was injected into him, and he saw on his inner screen a complete movie of the days to come, of the battle, and he saw himself making the decisions. He watched he saw the battle, he saw the outcome, not as if from inside himself, but from a kind of God's eye view. He saw that the NATO forces would win the battle. He would be the victor, in other words. And then he saw a series of events that ended up the next day or 2 days later with him getting a phone call from the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff informing him that he was being fired from his position as head of this section of the armed forces. He said that he then went into the battle, into the events to come, including getting fired. And he said everything happened exactly the way he'd seen it. And I said, wow, you were really lucky you got to see that. Otherwise, you would have been, incredibly shocked and worried. He said, I was really shocked. Even seeing it beforehand didn't keep me from being shocked. But he told me that from that moment on, he understood how there are forces at work in life, whether we call them destiny or, God, that really are above and beyond personal will. He saw that something is in charge that does not have anything to do with our ego's ideas of what and who we are. Even when things turn out, quote, well for us, they still don't have anything to do with our ego or our preferences. So this is what the Spandakarika is really telling us, that my life, my individual life, is a natural expression of the divine will, and that whether we feel that we're aligning ourselves with divine will or not, nonetheless, Spanda is expressing herself as your total ability to experience your life, however you're experiencing your life. Spanda, in all of her glory and beauty and extraordinary power, expresses herself as your life. She is the power behind your senses, behind the workings of thoughts, even behind the feeling of egoity. And I think this is so important, even if you're not experiencing it immediately, just to have this understanding. Because one of the big difficulties that we have as spiritual seekers is this feeling that there's a difference between divine will and my will, right? That there's this kind of opposition between what I want or what God wants. And when things aren't going the way the ego wants them to go, there's this terrible feeling that, you know, maybe we've blown it, or maybe there's something we're supposed to do to make things different. And in any case, that, you know, there's something we need to do other than what we're doing to be in alignment with divine will. It's something so paradoxical about this, that on the one hand, there is alignment, and on the other hand, divine will is happening whether the ego itself is aligned with it or not. And in my experience, in general, suffering is caused by what the mind does as it tries to make something happen that is different than what is actually happening. You know, suffering is caused by trying to make the mind, by the mind believing that something is supposed to happen that's different than what's ordinarily happening. And of course, the paradox here is that ethics and right action and kindness and respect for the dignity of the individual are all completely necessary and important in the way we're living our lives. And of course, we do have a choice as to how we behave and how we hold our lives. And yet, on the other hand, the very forces that make us able to be kind are the forces of the Spanda. And I would say that one deep reason why the tantric understanding is such a subtle understanding, why it's so crucially important that a person who lives with this understanding be spiritually mature, is because it's not an awareness that gets us off the hook of doing the best we can to be, you know, what I, for want of a better word, I'll call a good person, you know, for doing our best to be kind and grateful and skillful. And yet, the attitude of realizing that it's not our personal self that is being kind or gentle or skillful or appropriately fierce is crucial for that deep relaxation into being that is really the secret of true tantric action. So, Tantra asks us to remove the distinction between divine will and individual will, and to recognize that this is important, that individual will is actually divine will focused on limited objects. Individual will is divine will focused on limited objects, or let's say attached to limited objects. Individual will is divine will focused on limited objects. So, the spiritual practices that start to reveal the great force that behind will and desire really has to do with turning desire back from limited objects. And in the tantric system, it's about learning how to be with the limited, with the desire that arises without necessarily focusing on the object. In other words, that even, you know, an apparently non-spiritual desire can lead us back to the spanda that it's its source if we learn how to turn it back from the object, let go of the object. You know, again, when we direct our power, the power of desire, to a specific object, we truncate it in one way or another. We cut that desire off from its energetic source. So that vast engine, that vast power of holy will, which is the source of all creation and all creativity, gets filtered through the mind and senses of a human individual who feels separate from the source and therefore feels a sense of lack. And that sense of separation, that sense of lack, of course, is what leads us to look for something to fulfill that sense of lack, which could be anything, food, another person, an achievement, a spiritual experience. And because nothing that's not the source itself can really fulfill that sense of lack, can fill that sense of lack, then there's going to be suffering in the sense of incompleteness. So the movement of desire is its own natural force. The egoic sense of personal limitation and lack will very naturally move to find an object for it. And what we can train ourselves to do is to feel that movement of desire towards the object and immerse ourselves in the feeling of desire, to kind of catch that feeling of desire. And just feel that desire itself while more or less removing your sense of having to achieve the goal that has incited the desire. So this is really the art of learning to work with desire in Tantra. It's the art of learning how to let desire rest in itself. So we're going to do that practice now, and, you know, again, you might want to shake yourself out because I know there have been a lot of words here. and perhaps re-find your connection to your physical body, your connection to the seat, your connection to the chair, your connection to the breath. And I'd like to ask you to get in touch with a strong desire. I know some of you at this time in your life have a strong desire, whether a romantic desire, a professional desire, something to do with your family or your health, or maybe a desire to be free of something that's troubling you. And if you are one of those people whose life has gone beyond desire, to see if you can take yourself back to a time in your life when you had an intense desire for someone or something. And the way to activate desire for most of us is to bring ourselves into the sense of the desired object, the goal, the particular outcome, what is it that you want, what you most want now in your life. And you don't need to sort of sort through your various desires, which I know some of us will do. Just find the one that comes to mind when you ask yourself that question. What do I really want right now? Now feel the energy, the pulsing energy that arises, that's actually energized by the goal, by the thought of what it is that you want, and that's directing itself towards what you want. Can you feel where it is in your body? Can you feel the impulse, the rush of wanting? What's the sensation of wanting? Where is it located? Can you feel it throbbing or pulsing? Can you feel it getting more intense? See if you can let it become as intense as possible. Even intense to the point of discomfort. Now see if you can let go of the object of desire, the person or the thing or the state that you want. Just remove it. And let yourself be fully in the impulse of desire itself. Let yourself fully feel the sensation of desire, of wanting, pure wanting. And breathe into that part of your body, mind, where you feel the strong wanting. Just let yourself be with the pulsation of desire with the breath. Now see if you can feel the space, the subtle field that surrounds and contains the feeling or sensation of desire, and through which the breath arises and subsides. Desire without an object is the pure throbbing energy of life. Spanda. And as the breath flows in and around that concentration of energy, for some of you it may have widened and dispersed, for some it may feel very focused. See if you can feel together the felt sense of the impulse that took form as a desire and the breath. And see if you can allow the concentration of desire energy to begin to break up into particles. See if you can feel the breath flowing in and out of the desire feeling and the space around it. And if thoughts are arising, which I know they are for many of you, just let them keep coming up. But coming back to the felt sense of the desire pulsation in the breath. as you stay with the breath and the energy, whatever energy you're sensing arising and subsiding, I also want you to know that this practice is actually one of the super advanced practices of the Spanda tradition. So even a moment of having it become real for you is kind of a big deal. Even a recognition that it's possible to experience desire without an object and follow it inside, to sense that pure throb as an object of meditation that can lead you into its very source. So I'm wondering if anyone has a comment or a question or something to say about what it was that we just did. And if so, you can press *7 and speak to us. Tell us what happened or ask a question. And it's also completely fine to express confusion as well as share revelations. So press 7 to unmute, to share or ask a question.
Sally?
Yes.
Hi, this is Christine.
Hi, Christine. How are you?
Hi there. I'm good. What a beautiful, beautiful treatise on desire. I'm so grateful. It's very healing. I know that before I met you, I was following kind of contemplative Christian and non-dual and Buddhist things, and I thought that desire was the heart of suffering, and so I just went out to stop desiring anything, and I really shut my life down. I mean, really, passion left and vitality left, and I was depressed, and it was like, oh, fiddlesticks, that's no good.
right.
It was really horrible. But then after, you know, the Kundalini stuff started and started working with Tantra, it was just beautiful, but it wasn't a bad thing. And the only thing more that I had to say is that with this particular meditation you just led, it was absolutely an exquisite experience, because I've had a big desiring to get back into life and make friends and find purposeful work, and went into it, and it was a beautiful spacing, just heart throb of life. It was, well, there's tears trying to explain it, really gorgeous. So thank you.
Oh, that's so beautiful, Christine. And it's desire, it's the pulse of life, as you say, and it's the suffering is not, it's not to do with desire itself. It's to do with all the ideas we have about, you know, how we need to have the desire fulfilled in a particular way in order to be happy. But desire itself is delight. So thank you for sharing that. It's really gorgeous.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, we always like what you, the way you express these things on the listserv as well as in your voice on the call.
Sally, I have a question.
Yes, who's this?
This is Lauren from Boston.
Hi, Lauren.
Hi, thank you. Could you differentiate between desire and addiction and things that actually defeat one? For example, desire for food and drink could be a good thing in that we love to drink and eat, but at the same time, it has sort of a hook in it.
Right.
And it, one can be addicted to that. So the joy of the result of that desire can actually lead to attachment. So
true.
Yeah, you could walk me through this, please.
Yes, and it's a great question. First of all, the desire, the difference between the natural desire for pleasure, which is one of the beautiful things in life, you know, the tantricas are all about pleasure, which is one of the great things about tantra. But what they always ask you to do is, well, two things. First of all, to stay with the initial experience of satisfying that desire. You know, for instance, if it's food, if it's a glass of wine, if it's a beautiful thing, if it's, you know, the pleasure of being with someone that you love, to actually let yourself focus on the in the now, in the moment. And this is really crucial, the present moment experience of that joy. Because the thing that leads to addiction is that, you know, we experience that moment of pleasure or enjoyment, and then we try to use it in the next moment to fill a sense of lack. And the whole process of self-inquiry, of like inquiring into the nature of desire by doing what we just did, that is, feeling the impulsion of desire and then stepping back from the object and feeling directly into the desire itself will start to show us the difference between desire itself and that whole complex of thought and action that leads our enjoyments to become addictions. So I know there's a lot of physiological things that lead to addiction, having to do with the dopamine center, the reward system, and conditioning and certain tendencies that seem to be physically based. But at the very heart of them is the feeling of lack, the feeling of needing something to complete us. And I would say also that when we have an addictive issue, which I think 100% of all human beings do to some extent, if we're not addicted to one thing, we're addicted to something else. I think the idea that there's anybody who doesn't have an addictive personality is, you know, ridiculous, because in our time, there's so much emphasis on satisfying ourselves from the outside. It's very hard not to experience some form of addiction. But in order to work with addiction, it is necessary to really practice with feeling the moment of desire and then not letting the desire move out into action towards the goal. So a certain amount of discipline is necessary in order to work with desire. You have to kind of stop yourself from going there long enough to feel the natural movement of desire itself and the satisfaction that's inherent in desire itself. So does that make sense?
Well, yes, it does, except I have the feeling of being captured
by the addictive behavior.
Addictive behavior, yes. and various other things. I mean, entertainments and
yes, right
so
on.
Forth. Excuse
absolutely.
Me.
Yeah, yes. So in order to work with those addictive behaviors, and you're right, it can be anything. You know, I mean, if you, for instance, watch TV for three nights running, you're probably going to find that on the fourth night there's a compulsion to watch TV. And I don't think there's anyone in the world who doesn't feel it. So the secret is always to turn back. Even if just for a moment you feel that impulse to watch TV, you feel yourself getting captured, and this is where the effort comes in. You turn your attention around and feel the felt sensation of being captured before you find that you've turned on the TV or that you've put the cookie in your mouth. at some point you have to have a strong enough desire to find out what it is that's capturing you so that you'll do that initial practice of self-inquiry. And if an addiction is really intense, if it's really powerful, if it's really got hold of you, then normally some kind of psychological intervention, which can be anything from, removing all the cookies from the house or putting the TV away or, something that actually gives you some space may be necessary and important. So this practice is not instead of doing what you might do to work with unhealthy addictions. It's really an encouragement to use those moments when you are capable of looking into the energy of desire to do that. And I can promise you that as you do, you'll more and more feel the independence of your own impulses and be able to, as it were, harness the power of desire to turn you towards a deeper sense of priorities that can let you just hold off being captured for. And I, honestly, you just have to do it for 5 minutes at first, because the last thing we want to do is beat ourselves up about, having the extra cookie. It's not about trying to get us to be ascetics. It's really about the process of self-inquiry and starting to realize that satisfaction can be found in just feeling the pulsation of desire itself. There's another practice, by the way, which is also very helpful in working with compulsions, and we can do that now for a moment. Taking that desire, or any smaller desire that might be coming up, which is which could be something as simple as the desire to have this all be over with so you can watch TV or have supper, is to ask yourself the question, what do I want by fulfilling this desire? What is the state I really want? What do I want by getting what I want? And then to use your imagination to imagine this desire being fulfilled.
Well, there are tantric practices also that, celebrate food and drink, and so that you get feel that ecstasy, tantric sadhana.
Totally, exactly. And the thing about those tantric practices is that what they ask you to do is to contemplate the perfect condition of that enjoyment. In other words, the experience of fulfillment that you get in taste. Because if you're really feeling, if you're really fully experiencing the taste, then it's going to lead you to an internal experience. And you'll start to notice that more of that does not necessarily give you that same initial experience of satisfaction. Do you know what I mean?
At that point, I kind of lost my way, though.
Yeah.
More is better.
Yeah.
I'm feeling good
now.
I'll
feel better if I have more.
Impossible. Absolutely.
Exactly. So if you're really paying attention to the feeling of satisfaction, let's say in the initial taste of the cookie, or whatever it is, or for instance, the enjoyment of sexual desire, and sometimes in sex, it's the desire stage, it's the most pleasurable. And then notice where the desire, where the satisfaction stops and becomes compulsion. And then you just stay with the satisfaction. You learn to not go beyond that. Yes. Yes.
Got it.
So thank you. Thank you. Thank you for that question. It's one of the great questions. Sorry, go ahead. What are you going to say?
Oh, just my pleasure. Thank you so much for your generosity.
Oh, my pleasure too. And thank you for the question. You know, there are a couple of questions that come up with this teaching. One of them is the one you just asked. The other one is the one that Christine mentioned, which is the feeling that you're supposed to do without desire, you know, without friends, without food, without pleasure, that old lifetimes as a monk thing. So you know, you're right. The tantric texts are full of beautiful meditations for enjoyment. That if you really enter into them, will allow you to have what my guru used to call disciplined enjoyment. My guru used to say that disciplined enjoyment is the highest form of renunciation.
Whoa.
Which
awesome.
Is really, yeah, it's a fantastically good prescription for a tantric life, actually.
Hmm.
So,
Right.
Yes, it's a good dharana.
Thank you.
So, you're so welcome. Thank you. You know, and I think that part of what you were getting at here, we're going to do one final meditation before we end, and I'm going to suggest that. Oh, okay, there's one more question? So, yes. Speak.
Sally, it's Carly.
Hi, Carly.
Hi. That was really cool. Thanks, Lauren, for asking that. My question's a bit more geeky. I've been geeking out on the Unmesha and Nimesha.
Yes.
In relation to the first verse, and now I'm wondering about it and geeking out in the context of this talk and desire. And I'm sitting with the idea that when Shankara opens his eyes, we have Unmesha, and when the eyes close, we have Nimesha. But when I sit with it from the perspective of Shakti, which I'm feeling now as Bandha Shakti and desire, Isha Shakti,
yeah.
When the eyes open then, is that Nimesha as opposed to Unmesha?
Well, if you remember, if you want to get really geeky about these verses, the Unmesha, which always means the appearance or the opening out into, Nimesha always means the withdrawal. So when you open your eyes, there's the appearance of the external world. When you close your eyes, the external world dissolves, although for most of us it remains as a sort of after image, and there's the appearance of the internal world. So in terms of desire, in terms of Unmesha, Nimesha of desire, so when we imagine something that we really want, that we really desire, there's the Unmesha of the image of what we desire and the Nimesha of you know, stillness, as it were. And
yep.
Then when you deliberately turn your attention back to the pulsation of the desire, there is the Nimesha, or the disappearance of the object, and the Unmesha, or expansion of the felt sense of desire. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So, you know, so there's always an expansion and contraction going on. And then the expansion might be of the object, or the expansion may be of the feeling. And so you can look at your whole life as, you know, in terms of inquiring into what's expanding and what's contracting right now, and it'll show you a lot about reality.
Yeah, no, that's what I've been doing, and it's literally been blowing me away. So
it's a blow away. It really is.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Love to you, Kali. So we have one more question, and
I would. Yes. Hi, Sally. It's Wendy. And I'm just wondering, that little conversation you just had about expansion and contraction, that's the same as that dance of holding on and letting go, right?
Totally.
And how holding on happens inside letting go, and letting go has to happen to hold on.
Yes, really true, true, true. Yes. So you can look at expansion, contraction in so many different ways. You know, your arm rises and it's an expansion of movement. Your arm lowers and it's a contraction. You know, everything can be seen in terms of expansion, contraction, of holding on and letting go.
So one last thing. So the objectless desire, really in that context, is how you learn to want what's actually happening right now.
Yeah, that's definitely an incredibly skillful way of recognizing that whatever is happening in reality at this moment is what's supposed to happen. You know,
mm-hmm.
that's the deepest meaning of surrender or letting go. So, very much worth contemplating.
Thank you.
I think you're so welcome, Wendy. I think Patricia had a question, or did it get answered? Hello?
Sally, can you hear me?
Yes.
It's Patricia.
I can.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm having trouble getting in. Yes, the question, say that a persistent desire is that I don't mean to sound pretentious, but, you know, knowing God, Satchitananda, being filled with that luminous, boundless love. And are you implying that if you feel that desire, and you may not in the moment be feeling the fulfillment of the desire, that if you stay with the desire, it can lead you to the fulfillment of the desire? Is that what you're saying? Because I think there's great deep truth in that.
Yeah, it's an incredibly profound spiritual teaching. That's, Kabir, for instance, the great Indian poet saint. He said two things that I've been contemplating for many, many years. First of all, he said, when it's God you long for, it's the intensity of the longing that does the work. You know, the more strong. And the second thing he said is that God, love, you know, truth is in your longing. So, which, you know, in other words, Spanda is God, Spanda is truth, Spanda is love. So it's there in that longing. And of course, the longing for God, the longing for Satchitananda, the longing for the deepest love, as you know, is it's really the engine that brings about that fulfillment. I mean, honestly, in my experience, you know, I may never have been able to get that boy I had a crush on in the sixth grade to have a crush on me. but in my experience, the more the longing for love takes the form of longing for the ultimate love, you know, however that manifests for you in a given moment, there's an inevitability about that. That, you know, I think you know from your life experience, or as Rumi says, I never knew that God too desires us.
It helps to be 78 also.
Helps to be 78, yes.
Thank you for taking the time.
Oh, thank you for the question. You know, it's the way I sort of experience this is that longing is the swinging door. You know, somehow in spiritual life, the word longing feels more spiritually correct, politically, you know, let's call it SC, more spiritually correct than the word desire, but they're really the same. They're really not different. But you know, it's when we attach it to something that's limited, even including our idea of what divine love feels like, right? Then there's suffering. There's a feeling of separation. But it's when we turn back and feel into the desire itself or the longing itself, we really see that it it's all there.
Mm. It's true. Oh,
it's
Thank
true.
You.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a there's a very famous Kabbalah story that I'm going to tell you in 2 seconds. It's a story about a sage who falls in love with a princess, and he's, you know, he's old and poor and not very good looking, and so, but he approaches the princess, and he asks her to come and meet him and have a, you know, a rendezvous with him, and the princess says that will happen in the graveyard. You know, she's being sarcastic. She means no way. But the sage takes it literally, and he goes and sits in the graveyard to wait for her. And as he waits for her, he meditates on her, and of course she doesn't come. And then little by little, he finds that the thought of her is dissolving, and he's just experiencing the white hot intensity of his longing until he's totally aflame with the intensity of longing. And the story goes that the sage attains enlightenment. And this is a, you know, there's a Sufi version of this story also about the story of Laila and Majnu, in which the unfulfilled longing, which starts as a longing for a person, but can be a longing for anything, turns back on itself and becomes just pure desire and shows us the spanda. So the sadhana of feeling into the nature of your own desire is an incredibly powerful one. And let's just be still for a moment. And we're going to be working, practicing with desire in different ways over the week, so you'll be getting homework about it. But just be still and close your eyes. And let your attention settle into the breath. And let's become present to our longing for love, our desire for love, whether it's the desire for a particular form of human love or our desire to feel more love or our desire for the great love. And just let yourself, with the breath, just tune into that natural flow of longing for love. And then ask, is there any love present in this moment? Is there love here in the atmosphere? Is there love present in my body? Is love available now? Is there love present? And just become aware of the felt sense that arises as a result, not the thoughts that arise, but just the delicate experience of something that we might call presence, that we might call the vibratory quality in reality, in the air, in your body. Whatever answers that question, is there any love present? And have the feeling that the area in the center of your chest is opening like the shutter of a camera. And that with the breath and through that opening, in a very delicate way, the energy of love is pouring into your body. And you might also have the feeling that the center of the crown of the head is opening, and that love is pouring in through the crown, whether in the form of energy, in the form of a feeling of flowing spaciousness, or in the form of a delicate warmth, feeling of acceptance. Just let these centers and even your whole body open to that presence that is flowing always. Allowing your body to receive the tenderness that's pouring into you from all directions. Letting yourself breathe with it. Letting yourself be present with it. Letting yourself receive it. And as we bring this session to a close, and as you go forward into the rest of your day or your evening, see if you can allow yourself to remain present to that sense of tenderness or presence. And see if at the same time you can allow the breath to create a kind of cocoon of protective energy that flows from your heart and wraps around you, so that you can allow yourself to be open to the energy that flows into you from the Spanda. And also allow the energy of Spanda to enclose you, to hold you, to keep you protected, so that you can allow that subtle force field of Spanda Shakti to work within you, even as she protects you from whatever in the surroundings might be disruptive. And I'd suggest that if possible, you sit for a few moments at the end of the call and just let yourself feel the way in which the Spanda Shakti is simultaneously opening you and holding you, so that the alchemical container within which these practices are creating inner transformation can be held and strengthened. Thank you so much for satsang, for your presence, for your questions, for your practice. Have a wonderful week. Namaste. Love and blessings.